This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. After the series of major storms that hit America's coastal areas during the last decade, we've heard a lot about resilience and preparation for another major storm like Sandy or Katrina. But how ready are our major cities for another storm of that magnitude? The public radio show Reveal, which is a project of the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, along with its partner, the Texas Tribune, is exploring this question. It got us thinking about how well prepared we are for storms here in Connecticut. We'll be hearing more about that in a few minutes, but first, to focus on Houston, Texas. It's one of America's biggest cities, and it was right in the path of Hurricane Ike back in 2008. That storm caused tens of billions of dollars of damage and killed nearly 200 people in its path. You can join the conversation, comment on our website, wnpr.org/where we live. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. Our first guest is an investigative reporter with Reveal. She was also a reporter here in 2012 when Superstorm Sandy hit our region. Nina Satija is an investigative reporter and producer for the Texas Tribune and Reveal. And she joins us from the studios today of KUT in Austin, Texas. Nina, welcome back to Where We Live.
Thanks a lot, John. It's great to be here.
So first of all, tell us what you're looking at during this Reveal project.
Yeah, well, really, we're looking at what will happen when the next big storm hits Houston. When a storm hits Houston at the right spot with the right wind speed, scientists say it's going to happen. These are not storms that happen every year, but they're storms that could happen once in a generation. And are we ready? We looked at that for several months here at the Texas Tribune and ProPublica, and we concluded that it doesn't look like it.
Mm. So before we get into that future and some of the things that you found, let's go back in time to Hurricane Ike, back to 2008. What can you tell us about that storm, and why is the damage from that storm so significant to the story you're telling right now?
Yeah, Hurricane Ike is it's actually the third costliest hurricane to hit the U.S. A lot of people don't realize that. First was Katrina, then Superstorm Sandy, and then Ike caused $30 billion in damage. And it was really, though, a near miss. It could have been a lot worse. For several days before the storm made landfall, folks thought it was going to kind of hit Houston more directly. That would have caused what one scientist referred to as hellacious surges on the Houston Ship Channel, which is a major international port and industrial hub in the Houston area, as well as in suburban Houston, where there's other, you know, narrow water channels that jut off the bay. You know, most people that we've talked to have estimated that thousands would have died in that situation. Rick Perry, who was governor at the time, he actually recalled in an interview several years later that it was one of his most defining moments as governor, remembering Ike's approach and what could have happened. The hurricane turned at the last minute, just about 6 hours before landfall, and the surge estimates were all overestimates. It turned out to be about a 10 to 15 foot surge on the ship channel, as opposed to a 25-foot surge. But really, it got a lot of scientists here thinking, we are not ready for this. You know, we got lucky, and we're not going to continue to get lucky. I spoke with the congressman from the Houston area, Pete Olson, who had, a great phrase for it. He said, we can't keep depending on the Lord moving storms for us. One day, one's going to hit us, and we have to be ready.
And this notion of thousands of people being killed in one of America's largest cities truly is terrifying. As it is, Ike killed dozens of people in Texas. It caused about $30 billion of damage. Yet the other people that I referred to who were killed were in Haiti along the path of the storm. Here's some tape of Houston's then-Mayor Bill White. He was urging people not to stay in their homes during the storm.
If you think you want to ride something out and people are talking about a 20-foot wall of water coming at you, then you better think again.
I wonder if you can comment on that part of the story, Nina, how seriously people took warnings from officials about the seriousness of the storm that was coming.
Yeah, well, you know, John, the data that we have seems to show they didn't take it all that seriously. Galveston Island in particular, so Galveston is you know, totally surrounded by water pretty much. It's off the coast in Texas. Galveston was really quite devastated by Ike. It could have also seen worse damage, but the estimates are that, you know, tens of thousands of people, I think, stayed on the island during the storm when really they should have evacuated. They were under a mandatory evacuation order, although some say it came a little too late. And the National Weather Service was actually saying, you know, if you don't leave, you may face certain death. The only other time the National Weather Service has issued a warning like that was before Katrina. So it was really quite a dire situation, and hundreds of people ended up having to be airlifted out of Galveston and the peninsula next to it called Bolivar. So really not enough people evacuated, and we got lucky. Evacuations are always tricky across the U.S. You know, people, it's hard to get people to take these things seriously. And a lot of people were probably remembering Hurricane Rita, which happened in 2005. Hurricane Rita, because it happened right after Katrina, really scared a lot of folks in Texas. And so in some ways, too many people evacuated, even from zones that were quite far from the coast. And it was an evacuation disaster. I believe dozens of people died on the road in the heat in traffic. And then the storm didn't end up being as bad as people expected. And so a lot of folks didn't evacuate during Ike, remembering the debacle of Rita. But this is the problem with storms and evacuations, is that it's not about what happened last time. It's about what could happen the next time.
Well, and of course, you know, many, many thousands of people fled after Katrina from New Orleans, and many of them relocated to cities like Houston and never left. Mm-hmm. And so probably that is what was on their minds during Rita. And of course, things changed around Ike. We're talking today with Nina Satija. She is an investigative reporter and radio producer for the Texas Tribune and Reveal. It's a public radio program and podcast from the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX. Their special Hell and High Water is a collaboration between the Texas Tribune, ProPublica, and Reveal. We're talking about storm preparedness, what we can learn about big storms like Hurricane Ike and what it can teach us about the Northeast. In just a little bit, we're going to be talking about that. So as you heard from people, Nina, essentially officials in Houston and in Texas were saying, look, we can't just rely on God to turn the storm away from us every single time. So you set out to see what would happen if the area was hit head on by a mightier Ike. Walk us through what exactly you did to model that and figure out what a bigger Ike might do.
Yeah. So, excuse me. What we did was we talked to a lot of scientists in the region. And the scientists are the ones who created these incredible models of what storms could do to the Houston region. And they're actually, you know, technology has made this way better. We've had this modeling, you know, around for quite a long time. National Weather Service uses it to imagine what storms could be like, what they could do. But this is actually a newer technology. It's called ADCIRC. And these models predict what could happen with amazing specificity. They look at actual, you know, they can predict how high the water will get. They can subtract out what the base land elevation is. So if you live on land that's 10 feet above sea level, that'll be taken into account, you know, looking at how high the storm surge would be at your property or whether you would see storm surge. They can even take into account sort of smaller levee systems and basically any change in the terrain that would affect how high a storm surge might get. So they're really quite specific. They look at, of course, the wind speeds and the wind direction of the storm. And essentially, they predict if the storm were to hit at this angle, you know, with this wind speed, here's how high the water would go at different areas. We got models from scientists at the University of Texas at Austin and scientists at Jackson State University. Some of the models were originally created and developed at FEMA and the U.S. Army Corps. And we basically took those and our data team at ProPublica. They did an amazing job. They put these models onto an interactive map that you can look at online. So you can kind of see the storm surge go over Houston in these different storm scenarios. So that was essentially the centerpiece of our project, was looking at what these models predict. And they really are, as I said, quite specific in a way that models just a few years ago were not.
Among the people you talked with, it was Sam Brody, a professor of marine sciences at Texas A&M University. He'd been studying the Houston region's vulnerability to flooding and storm surge for a lot of years. When you met, he took you on a tour of Clear Lake, a suburban residential area of Houston that experts say is really at risk. Let's listen.
This is going to be a shopping center one day. And so we're going to add more people and more structures and more pavement. And so we have a decision that we can say, okay, if we're going to do that, can we do it differently? Does that make sense? Can we understand the risk better and have models like this? Like, hey, look, you could be under 8 feet of water. I would be shocked if the developers of that shopping center knew that when they put that in.
And Nina, you spoke to the developer of the shopping center that Brody was talking about. What did he say?
Yeah, he said, wow. He did not know about this model that predicted this shopping center could be under 6 or 8 feet of water. By the way, this model is called Mighty Ike, one of the names researchers have given one of the storm models. And he sort of said, well, look, you know, everyone's at risk. We're all at risk, not just my shopping center. And I will say this is something that we heard again and again and again when we talk to folks on the Upper Texas Coast in the Houston region. Yes, we're at risk, but we're all at risk. Why are you talking to me? You should be talking to this other guy. And, you know, it makes sense. It's probably something you'd hear across the coast, not just in Houston. But at some point, it's like, well, we have to have a conversation about this and what we can do about it. And if you keep pointing to the next guy, we're not really going to get anywhere.
And, of course, this plays right into how a region like Houston, which, as we all know, has been booming and growing and building for decades and decades. You talk with Bob Mitchell, president of the Bay Area Houston Economic Partnership, which recruits businesses to the Houston area and helps them expand. And you showed him the visualization of scientists' computer model of a worst-case scenario storm, which would put his office under several feet of water. Let's listen to that.
It's underwater.
It's underwater. It's underwater.
Trust me, I know that.
Why keep expanding this development if...
I can't believe that's a serious question.
Why? Well, why does that sound so difficult?
You're going to stop development? I mean, that's the same thing. There's no... That question you're asking me is no different than the terrorists right now. Am I going to stop everything I do because I'm worried about somebody going to charge into a store and shoot the place up?
Okay, so listening to that, Nina, I mean, first of all, give me your reaction to his reaction to this. Obviously, his is not the only voice you heard saying things like that. But what's the conversation like going on? Is he really saying, well, we can't let the hurricane win. We can't let the terrorists win. We want to build wherever we want to build?
You know, it's a version of that, John. And Bob's an interesting guy. He really... In other ways, he really thinks this is a serious problem and wants something to be done about it. And he's beating the drum to build a storm surge protection system in Texas. So he's got an interesting perspective. But yes, I think that a lot of folks see these storms as being so rare that it doesn't really make sense to, you know, change your development patterns in anticipation of them. And, you know, there's different opinions on that. Sam Brody would feel differently. You know, today, as many people may know, we mostly protect for storms that are considered 100-year storms, which actually, rather than meaning they're going to happen once in 100 years, it really means there's a 1% chance of that type of storm happening in any given year. And that's just not the way it is in the rest of the world. In Europe, in the Netherlands, they look at 1 in 10,000-year storms, and they're protecting to that level. And so I think that there's definitely mixed opinions on this. But I think what Bob Mitchell really was trying to say is that, you know, let's not stop our development patterns. Let's keep bringing businesses here. And rather than making all of us, you know, elevate our individual buildings 20 feet or whatever it should be, let's build a storm surge protection system, a coastal barrier system for Texas. Now, of course, there's no plans to do that anytime soon. And most people don't think it'll actually get built until we have a devastating hurricane. So it's kind of a weird viewpoint.
Well, and of course, the idea that this could in any way be similar to a terrorist attack, not knowing when that might happen, putting in certain precautions. Well, terrorists can attack anywhere and everywhere. What we do know just from science and statistics is a hurricane makes landfall in the Houston area about every 8 years, every 15 years. It's a major one. So it seems, Nina, like the numbers are really on the side of people who are saying we're going to get another one and it's going to be soon.
Yeah. You know, I mean, you'll hear people talk about how much money we spend to combat terrorism. And the likelihood of attacks. And we probably just haven't had enough to really calculate the likelihood of a terrorist attack. We've had enough storms. We have enough data to know generally what the likelihood of a storm like this is of happening, which, by the way, these are considered somewhere along about 500, 1 in 500-year storms. Again, that does not mean that it's going to happen once every 500 years, common misconception. What it means is there is a 0.2% chance of that type of storm happening in any given year. Every year, there's a 0.2% chance. Over 50 years, that translates to a 10% chance. And climate change is messing up all of these numbers. There's studies that show that 500-year storms could actually happen every few decades. So we know much more about the likelihood of a storm like this hitting than we do of a mass shooting or a terrorist attack. And, you know, you can make your own decisions about whether that means we should work to prevent damage.
A big storm like this, like Ike or like Sandy or Katrina, obviously it puts businesses of all sorts at risk, and it puts lots and lots of people at risk, and that's the thing we need to worry most about. But, you know, we worry about things like Superstorm Sandy sinking Wall Street underwater and shutting down stock markets for a couple days. Houston has a little different issue. It's home to one of America's largest oil refining and chemical manufacturing complexes. Talk about the risks there, because that seems like a pretty major one.
Yeah, it's a huge risk. This is a city that's home to, you know, by some accounts, the largest importing and exporting port in the U.S. Tens of billions of dollars worth of goods are exported out of the Houston Ship Channel every year. Thousands of ships come through the Houston Ship Channel every year. You've got 10 major refineries that line the Houston Ship Channel and dozens of chemical manufacturing plants. And actually, how much oil the refineries produce on any given day is proprietary, but the estimates we've heard are as much as 25% of the nation's gasoline is produced in those refineries every day. So it's a lot. And pretty much everyone we talked to said you're going to see, you know, on the order of $7 a gallon gas if this type of storm were to hit. Even after storms like Ike, and we all maybe remember Katrina, we saw a spike in gas prices for quite some time. So, you know, the Houston Ship Channel being shut down, even just for a day, estimates have found that it's, you know, something like $300 million a day in lost commerce when the Houston Ship Channel is shut down. So this kind of storm would put it out for several months, which would really, really cripple the national economy, according to every expert and analyst that we talked to. And it's not just gasoline. It's also the building blocks of plastic. Many of those are made on the Houston Ship Channel. So we're talking everything from car tires to tennis balls to Tupperware. Whatever makes the prescription pill inert, the inert part of a prescription pill, which is like 99% of that pill, a lot of that is made on the Houston Ship Channel. So we're really talking major impacts, even to consumer goods prices, if you were to see a shutdown for several months.
And of course, you showed your storm model to a number of people who were surprised, including, I believe it's Jana Palouche. She works at the Shell Oil Refinery right on the Houston Ship Channel. She lives in Deer Park, which is just across the highway from Shell. Let's listen.
This puts it in front of your face and makes it less abstract. So this is something that people need to see. It's not something that some reporters have dreamed up.
And because of these chemical and oil storage tanks located in this area, this particular area around Houston is at risk. What can you tell us about the damage that a big Ike-like storm could do to these tanks?
Yeah, it's pretty significant. So along with, you know, when you have refineries and chemical plants on a waterway like this, they store billions of gallons of oil and chemicals. And a lot of those storage tanks are not the regulations don't adequately protect them from something like storm surge, according to the experts that we talked to. And the best example of this is really something that happened during Hurricane Katrina. A huge oil tank, we're talking something wider than a football field, was actually ripped off its foundation near New Orleans during Hurricane Katrina by the force of rushing water. So just the force of the storm surge ripped this huge tank off of its foundation. It floated and it ruptured, and a million gallons of oil traveled through the receding floodwaters to a nearby neighborhood. And more than 1,500 homes were contaminated with oil, along with already being devastated by flooding. So it really can cause some pretty catastrophic damage. And since that Murphy oil spill, as it's called, it was the Murphy oil refinery, which is now bought by Valero in Louisiana. Since that spill, very little has been done, you know, from a government standards regulations standpoint to prevent something like that from happening again. What scientists tell us is that the chance of that happening on the Houston Ship Channel, where there are far more storage tanks at risk that also carry dangerous chemicals along with oil, you know, the risks are really quite great, either to neighborhoods near these refineries and chemical plants or to the environment, because the Houston Ship Channel leads out into Galveston Bay, which is a very productive estuary right on the Texas coast. So we could really see what scientists have called something on the order of the BP oil spill in terms of damage if a storm like Mighty Ike were to hit.
You spoke to a Marshall Mott Smith, who's a storage tank safety expert. He told you it's way too expensive to protect storage tanks from spilling in every storm scenario.
If you get a direct hit, there's just nothing you can do. You wait till it's all over, then you go pick up the pieces and you rebuild your tank.
That's not very reassuring, Nina.
It's not reassuring, no, John. And, you know, this is something that we got from a lot of folks in industry that we talked to. It was sort of, you know, don't look at us to protect our individual tanks. You know, again, let's build a coastal barrier system for Texas. That's great, but there are no plans in place right now to build anything anytime soon. And as I said before, a lot of folks we talked to predicted that it will take a devastating hurricane to get something built, which is essentially what happened in New Orleans after Katrina. They quite quickly rebuilt those levees, and even then they're not protected to a storm necessarily that would be like Katrina today. But that's what got it done. So that's certainly a sobering thought.
We'll be talking about the idea behind some of these barrier systems and also what the Northeast is doing to protect against a storm like a mighty Ike. Nina Satija is an investigative reporter and radio producer for the Texas Tribune and Reveal. It's a public radio program and podcast from the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX. Hell and High Water is a collaboration between the Tribune, ProPublica, and Reveal. When we come back, we'll talk to a state official about hurricane preparedness here in Connecticut. This is Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky on Reveal. It's a special called Hell and High Water, a collaboration between the Texas Tribune, ProPublica, and Reveal, which is a radio program and podcast from the Center for Investigative Reporting. Our former reporter, Nina Satija, is working on this project with the Texas Tribune and Reveal, and she joins us today from the studios of KUT in Austin, Texas. We're going to find out what they've learned about how a big storm could impact the Houston area. What it might teach us about Connecticut, of course, back in 2012, we were hit by our own superstorm. Here's Governor Daniel Malloy during a briefing on Hurricane Sandy.
Let me see if I can put this in context. Right now, the most likely scenario has a storm surge in Long Island Sound of 7 to 10 feet. We've seen estimates as high as 11 feet above typical high tide. That would lead to unprecedented flooding. To put it in perspective, with Irene, we had a 4-foot surge. So we're talking about a surge more than double the surge of Irene as a real possibility. In fact, the last time we saw anything like this was never.
That's Governor Daniel Malloy back in October of 2012 as we prepared for Superstorm Sandy. Nina, you were in Connecticut when Sandy came through the Northeast. Listening to the governor there, it sounds an awful lot like some of the messages we were hearing from Houston officials around the time of Hurricane Ike. What are your recollections of the storm and how our state handled it?
Yeah, I remember that briefing very well. I believe I was watching it on my TV at home. And it was a very scary moment. I really, the governor looked quite terrified. And then as I recall, what happened is, the storm moved more slowly than we thought. And so the storm surge here in Connecticut didn't coincide with high tide the way we expected. But it really, that moment got me thinking a lot about, are we prepared for something like this? Or will there be a discussion after Sandy about how Connecticut got lucky? And that didn't really happen, which was surprising to me. And, and then I spent a lot of the next year sort of looking at the most vulnerable areas in Connecticut and what was being done. But to me, in my opinion, that discussion didn't happen. And it's been much the same here after Hurricane Ike. When I got to Texas, I went pretty quickly. There was a 5-year anniversary conference that scientists had, 5 years since Ike, in 2013. And they said much the same thing about Houston and about Texas, was we had this near miss that was Ike. And since then, we've been trying to do all of this research and generate discussion about being prepared for the next one, but we haven't gotten a lot of traction.
Nina, stand by. I want to bring in William Shea, who's Deputy Commissioner of Connecticut's Department of Emergency Services and Public Protection, where he's responsible for the Division of Emergency Management and Homeland Security. Bill Shea, welcome to the program. Thanks so much for being here.
Good morning, John. It's good to see you again.
But first of all, tell me how prepared you believe we were for Hurricane Sandy back in 2012.
Well, the first thing I'll tell you is that the two major storms that we had in 2011, being Hurricane Irene and the October nor'easter, we learned a lot of lessons from those. And, Governor Malloy will be the first one to tell you that any time that we have a disaster, there will be lessons that are learned. So under Governor Malloy's leadership in 2012, we convened what was called the – what is called the EPPI, Emergency Planning and Preparedness Initiative. And what that was a disaster exercise that we had here in the state. It involved all our state agencies. It involved our non-governmental organizations and our 169 municipalities and two tribal nations. And it was a hurricane-based exercise that we had in the summer of 2012, which really set us in a good posture for being able to prepare and respond to Superstorm Sandy. So that was really the big piece that we had laid up front. The second piece I'll tell you is that all those municipalities having participated in that exercise and are constantly working and preparing for the next disaster, we've got to give recognition to them because those local emergency management directors, those chief elected officials working on their local operations plans really make a difference in the preparation and the ability to be able to respond. And lastly, our citizens. We ask our citizens to be partners in our preparation and response to any of these type of disasters where and you've probably heard us say and talk about this, get a kit, make a plan, and stay informed. And them being part of this, all three of those parts make all the difference.
So the major things that changed after Sandy, after that hit, I mean, we heard in the governor's voice the worry about the worst possible thing that happened. And much like the story that Nina's telling in Houston, we weren't hit as directly with this storm as we could have been, but yet it was still very, very damaging. So moving forward, the main things we learned about how to respond to a disaster like that and also prepare in a resiliency standpoint so that we wouldn't have terrible impacts.
Okay, a couple things on that. First one is as part of the response to that storm was recommendations for evacuation. And people did take heed to that, which makes a big difference. You know, the recommendations the governor made for the local municipalities, ordering for them to evacuate their local areas, and they did, and that obviously makes an impact. There was some, as I mentioned earlier, there's lessons learned every time there's a disaster. And one of the things that we didn't have because we hadn't needed it before was long-term recovery. And as part of Superstorm Sandy, because of the devastation that hit Connecticut, we ended up establishing a long-term recovery program. We hadn't had a need for it in previous storms, so that included establishing a long-term recovery coordinator for the state, establishing a long-term recovery committee, which includes state, local, federal, as well as non-governmental organizations. We established a recovery framework that is part of our state response framework for disasters. And this long-term recovery committee includes individual assistance working group, an economic recovery working group, natural and cultural resource working group, as well as a community planning and capacity building working group.
When you talk about the 169 communities, municipalities that have made up their own disaster response plans, how well coordinated are they? We often talk about how our municipalities not being hinged together by any county government may work independently of one another. In your assessment, a couple of years on from Hurricane Sandy or Superstorm Sandy here, how well coordinated are the municipalities in the way that they would respond locally?
I think every year they're getting better and better. We have, because we don't have county government, we've established five DEMIS supporting regions, if you will, regional areas. And each one of those regions, they work together and do planning. They do regional sheltering plans. They do all sorts of team building, if you will, mutual aid support, identification of resources that are available. Because as something hits and they have a requirement, the first place they need to go is from a local perspective is for mutual aid before coming to a state level. And that's the kind of building that goes on a daily basis. In each of those five regions, they have what's called an REPT, a regional emergency planning team, where they're constantly working on these plans to be able to work together as a team.
We're talking with William Shea. He's Deputy Commissioner of Connecticut's Department of Emergency Services and Public Protection. In listening to some of what Nina's reporting revealed, William Shea, I'm wondering if you can comment on this notion of economic development and or people's desire to build where they want. versus the need to really prepare for a storm. What we heard in the Houston area is a lot of people saying, well, look, I know your models might show that my new development is going to get flooded out, but we can't have that be in the way of me building where we want to build. I guess I'm wondering from your standpoint, how has Connecticut handled that issue about balancing the needs of economic development along a very expensive and important shoreline and making sure that these shoreline developments are safe from a storm surge?
Well, the big part of that is when building does occur, there's all sorts of permitting that's required, working with the State Department of Energy and Environmental Protection, as well as the local. So those are decisions that are made at that local level in conjunction with the state, especially when you get into floodplains and marshes and those kinds of areas. So there is a structure that is already in place for doing those kind of things. As part of Superstorm Sandy, there are resilience items that are ongoing on a daily basis. That includes hazardous mitigation grant funding that we've received from the federal government, in which we're involved with home elevations. So houses are being elevated so that if a storm hits again, the houses are at a higher level. Additionally, there is a community, what's called CDBGDR, Community Development and Disaster Relief Funding, that's gone through the Department of Housing, and there are resiliency projects that are ongoing on the coastline and a number of our communities.
But does that disaster relief funding, is it incentivizing building in place and rebuilding buildings where they were damaged, or is it incentivizing retreating from the shoreline or building buildings up or in a way more resilient than they were originally?
I think it's a little bit of both.
Maybe you could explain that a little bit, because I mean, I think, for instance, you talk about homes being raised up to a different level. Is that mandatory or is that optional? If a home was destroyed in Superstorm Sandy and it's rebuilt, must it be rebuilt to withstand a storm surge in a different way, or could it be rebuilt in the way that it was rebuilt built before?
That's a local decision that's made. With regards to the federal funding that's available, in order to do that, it requires elevation and it requires you to have flood insurance with that. Part of that hazardous mitigation funding also includes we do some home acquisitions in which, you know, it doesn't make sense for that home to continue to be there. Mm-hmm. And we've done some of that also.
Nina, can you talk about that from what you've learned from the Houston area, too, about the ways in which that region rebuilt after Ike or similar storms and what maybe is different moving forward?
Yeah, so I spent a lot of time talking to local officials, especially in the Clear Lake area. This is one of the fastest growing residential areas in the Houston metro area. And I got different responses. Those areas were still devastated by Hurricane Ike, although it wasn't as bad as it could have been. Some of them changed their building codes a little bit. In a few, you have to actually, if you're in the 100-year floodplain, your base elevation of your home has to be higher than the FEMA standards, 18 inches higher in one case and 2 feet higher in another case of two cities that I talked to. Still wouldn't protect against something like a 500-year storm, but is certainly better. So there have been changes. You asked about elevations, John. That's something that a lot of communities leaders brought up with me. They said, look, we have these grants from FEMA to elevate older homes. But, you know, the problem is that these grants don't – they're not going to be elevating hundreds of homes. It's a lot of money to elevate one home. The homeowner will also have to incur some of that cost, probably tens of thousands of dollars. So really only a few dozen homeowners have benefited from those in some of the Clear Lake area cities that I talked to. So there are a lot of efforts being made, I think. The scale is just not very big. It's just not a large scale. And I will say, too, that a lot of recovery dollars are used to build in areas that are flood prone. Most of the time, if you're using recovery dollars or you're rebuilding a house that was completely destroyed in a hurricane, if you want to be up to the FEMA code and have flood insurance, you probably do have to elevate if you weren't elevated before. But most of this is not going to protect against the type of storms that we have been writing about. The consensus seems to have been for a long time that we're just going to protect against what's called a 100-year storm. And that's what a lot of scientists and experts think needs to change.
Well, one of the, I think, more fascinating things about the work that Nina and Reveal is doing, Commissioner Shea, is this notion of showing people a model of what might happen in a worst case scenario. I guess I'm wondering, is your department, is anyone at the state looking at modeling like that? I mean, have you seen models very much like the ones that they've mapped out for a mighty Ike that says, here's what would happen to Milford, Guilford, New Haven, Brantford, and all these other places if indeed we get a storm much worse than Sandy was?
We see the flood maps that came out. There's a new series that just came out recently from the feds, and we have those and are reviewing those.
And what does it show you?
Well, it shows that, you know, there in along our coastline, there's vulnerabilities. There's no doubt about it. And that if you live in those areas, if you have businesses in those areas, and a storm of this type is coming, you're going to have requirements to evacuate.
Mm. I want to get to Pat, who's calling from New Haven. Hi, Pat. Go ahead.
I had a role in Nemo, Sandy, and Irene in one of the state's major cities. And a thing that continues to just be burning in me is a great concern about all of the elderly and people with disabilities that are living in housing that was built with public funds, who, when the power goes out, are stuck, often in multi-story buildings. And there is no planning in our state right now to put generator power in those buildings. There's been legislation in each of the last several sessions of the General Assembly. It's gone no place, just to do a study. And I really think this is very irresponsible. We need to have a plan. There could be funding that is made available to the people that own and operate those buildings, not for free, but to get it done quick and with payback over an extended period of time. If the state could provide bonding.
Pat, I'll take your answer off the air. And Pat, thank you very much, and I really appreciate your question. Commissioner, how can you respond to Pat?
Well, I will tell you that there is planning. If we have citizens with special needs, if they have to be evacuated or moved, there are plans in place for doing that, to include sheltering, regional sheltering, those kinds of things. Specifically,
I think part of Pat's issue is really is it is hard to get everyone out of some of these facilities, right?
Absolutely. And with that, always, if there is an evacuation requirement, that's why we look, forward X number of days, not just, oh, the storm's going to be here tomorrow. But with that, we'd have to go back and look specifically at any generator requirements or requests there. I'm not specifically familiar with that one, but we'll definitely take a look at it.
Nina, how is the region that you've been studying dealing with that very important issue?
Yeah, it's a really, really tough one, John. The state actually has a system called STEAR, S-T-E-A-R, and I don't recall exactly what it stands for, but it's essentially a registry system for folks that are elderly, disabled, may not have access to a car, that they can register, and then the state knows in advance of a storm, hey, these are the people that need to get out. This is where they live. Let's try and help them. But, what the chief emergency manager of the state told me, Nim Kidd, is that, look, people can register for this all year round, and we see the spikes 1 or 2 days before a storm hits, when it is way too late to get them out of there. It's just too late to evacuate, 1 day before a storm makes landfall. You're going to get stuck on the highway. And so it's a very, very tough problem. It's tough to convince a lot of folks to evacuate who may have trouble evacuating. They don't want to leave their homes because they know it could take them a very long time to get back. We saw that happen during Hurricane Ike in Galveston. People left and then they couldn't get back to their houses for 3 months or more. Katrina, a similar problem, makes people not want to evacuate. So it's a really tough problem. And then, of course, if you tell everyone, if you give them the doomsday scenario that you're thinking is going to happen, which is what happened with Ike and in some ways Sandy, and they take it seriously and they leave and the doomsday scenario does not occur, then you get blamed for it. So it's just a very, very, very difficult problem.
In terms of people not wanting to leave their homes, we got an email from Chip in East Haven who wants to ask you, Commissioner, about people not wanting to evacuate because of the worry of looting. He says that in East Haven, this is something I can't confirm, that there were looters during Superstorm Sandy. There are certainly problems with that in various areas that are evacuated. Is that a concern, and how do you deal with that issue?
I think that's a concern with anytime asking people to leave their homes. Obviously, this is a local issue within each of the municipalities, is that when an evacuation is ordered, that there's going to have to be road guards. It's going to require some sort of volunteer, or whether it be a CERT team, the community emergency response team, the local PD, or something, to be able to look at that area.
I understand how it works. An evacuation order could come from the state level, right?
It can.
So if an evacuation order comes from the state level, but each municipality is really responsible for those protection measures or some of the evacuation measures that you need to have in place, is there a disconnect there between a state-ordered evacuation and what each individual town might be able to do to respond to it?
We haven't done a state evacuation order. In the case of Superstorm Sandy, it was recommended, and the locals ordered the local municipalities ordered the evacuation.
But since we're in the notion that Nina has put forward in Houston, I guess I'm wondering if we can imagine a state evacuation order. If we can imagine what would happen right now if we had to have a state evacuation order, how well coordinated do you think that we are?
I think we've got the pieces in place to be able to respond to something like that. Tying in our state agencies, whether it's the National Guard, state police, local police responders. We have 97 communities in the state of Connecticut that have community emergency response teams, CERT teams, part of our Citizen Corps. They're volunteers that could do things like putting people at the end of roads or checking people to come in and out of a neighborhood as part of a security. There's a lot of pieces and parts that are in place to be able to respond to that.
When we come back from our break, we'll be bringing in Rick Bennett, who's a scientist for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and a coordinator of the service's Hurricane Sandy recovery and resiliency efforts, talking about more resiliency efforts here in the Northeast. If you want to join us, find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Today we're talking about a special from Reveal called Hell and High Water. It's a collaboration between the Texas Tribune, ProPublica, and Reveal. Nina Satija is a reporter for Reveal and Tribune. She joins us from KUT in Austin, Texas. William Shea is here. He's Deputy Commissioner of Connecticut's Department of Emergency Services and Public Protection. And for the last couple of minutes, I want to bring in Rick Bennett, a regional scientist for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service Northeast Region. He's also coordinator of the service's Hurricane Sandy recovery and resiliency efforts. Rick, welcome to Where We Live.
Thank you very much, John. Pleasure being here.
First of all, what's being done along the East Coast from your perspective to make our coastline more resilient?
Well, from our perspective, we're the Department of Interior and the Fish and Wildlife Service is investing a lot of money through Sandy relief funds to really restore natural systems and look at green infrastructure approaches to providing resilience to both communities as well as ecosystems. So if we restore ecosystems, it'll provide not only benefits for fish and wildlife resources, but it'll also provide services to local communities, whether that be infrastructure protection, economic, recreational, those kind of approaches. We're kind of taking three major approaches from our perspective. We're looking at beach dune complexes, our coastal wetlands, and then aquatic connectivity through dam removals. So that's our basic approaches that we're looking at, and be happy to.
Well, and I wonder if you could talk a little bit more about that. I mean, these are man-made barriers in some ways, but they're also using natural systems.
Yeah, so the green infrastructure approaches would be, I'll give you an example. So it's in Chesapeake Bay. It's Smith Island, a real historic island for crabbing, very vulnerable to storms. It has a large fetch, so the wind and waves can really hit there hard, very low elevation. So we're putting in living shorelines, which are considered green infrastructure. We're using basically some rock to protect 21,000 feet of shoreline, and then putting in living system sand and grasses and protecting these SAV beds and marshes that are behind it.
What can you tell us about what's happening in Connecticut right now?
In Connecticut, we have a variety of dam removal projects. So in New England, in general, we have lots of these low-head old mill dams. And I think we have at least five dams being removed in Connecticut through the Fish and Wildlife Service in partnership with the state, NGOs, a variety. None of these things happen by ourselves. You know, we have to work cooperatively. But what they're doing is when we take these dams out, there's two real benefits that go along with them. One, you get the we'll reestablish the runs for fish, so we remove barriers for passage. So that's really good from our perspective. But it's also providing flood protection. A lot of these dams are old. They're not well maintained. There's risk of catastrophic failures, and that would not be good. But even when you get storm events coming in, typically you get a lot of upstream flooding. Communities upstream of the dams get flooded out. So by taking them out, you're restoring the floodplains and allowing, now providing that protection to the communities while also providing the fish runs.
Bill Shea, maybe you can talk about how you're coordinating in efforts like this from your department.
Well, you know, there are a couple similar efforts that are ongoing. I mentioned earlier the CDBGDR, which is the Community Development Block Grant Disaster Relief through the Department of Housing. And then another one that we were involved with, led by, for the state of Connecticut, April Capone from OPM, which was the National Disaster Resiliency Competition, which was based on Superstorm Sandy, which was almost $1 billion that was made eligible on a competitive basis for the nation. And we were able to get $54 million awarded to the state of Connecticut, which will go to two projects here in Connecticut, which involve green infrastructure as well as access to transportation and those kind of things. So a very beneficial program, similar to what this gentleman mentioned. And there is a under that CDBGDR, there are some of those coastal programs involving beach and beach reconstruction and those kind of things.
Nina, we just have about a minute and a half left, but what's going on in Texas regarding resiliency programs like this?
So green space, very important. Also much cheaper than building a huge coastal barrier is letting natural systems absorb those floodwaters and protect communities. Bottom line here in Texas is it's not going to protect against a storm like Mighty Ike or a 500-year storm. It's not enough. I'm assuming that's probably the case, too, over up in the Northeast. Makes a huge difference. Not enough to protect against these real storms that scare people.
And Rick Bennett, I've just got a minute for you, but I'd love for you to respond to that. Part of the notion we're grappling with here is making us resilient and able to withstand not just the storms we've had, but the worst possible storm. What can you say about that briefly?
Well, I think if we have a large, complex natural systems in place, they'll do a lot to help on a major storm. Green infrastructure projects are going to be more geared to not those major catastrophic storms, but they'll help you on the general storms, really absorbing floodwaters, knocking down waves, those kind of things. But you know, you design things to a level of risk that you're willing to accept.
Willing to accept and willing to pay for, certainly. It's a fascinating conversation. Rick Bennett is a regional scientist for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, coordinator of the service's Hurricane Sandy recovery and resiliency efforts. Thank you so much, Rick. I appreciate it.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Thanks also to William Shea, Deputy Commissioner of Connecticut's Department of Emergency Services and Public Protection. He's responsible for the Division of Emergency Management and Homeland Security. Good to see you once again, sir. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
And Nina Satija, an investigative reporter and radio producer for the Texas Tribune and Reveal. Their special, Hail and High Water, is a collaboration between the Tribune, ProPublica, and Reveal. Always good to speak with you, Nina.
Thanks so much, John.
Our program produced by Lydia Brown and Tucker Ives. Our technical producer, Kyone Wolf. Heather Brandon's our digital editor. Our executive producer is Katie Tolarski. Continue this conversation online, wnpr.org/where we live.